dream was I look at my face in a mirror and I seem to be wearing a mask. And I say, well, I've got to take it off. There's another mask underneath. Okay, I take that one off. Oh, there's another one underneath. Oh, another one underneath. My friend Jeff McBride, the magician, has anybody ever seen him perform? We almost put in a picture of him in this thing because he says he based his biggest act in Las Vegas on my book, The Mythic Imagination. And in that magic act, he takes one mask after another off and throws them in a chamber, and it's just really breathtaking. It's beautiful. And of course, we know the Greek word for mask? Persona. And a personality is a collection of masks. And therefore, a personality is a committee. And guess what? Your committee may or may not always agree. And guess what, even further than that, if your committee really doesn't agree, you may have dissociative identity disorder, multiple personality disorder, or perhaps schizophrenia. That's the worst form of your committee not agreeing. It's really, really fragmented fault lines in the psyche. Okay, so chapter one, guess what? The dreaming brain. And the thing that I bring out there is we've only known about REM sleep for 60 years. 1953, Azarinsky and Kleitman, and then followed by William Dement, who did the first dream deprivation experiments. And I told you, when you deprive somebody of dreams, they get very, very anxious. And so we go into the brain stuff about dreaming. Now, my dissertation at Columbia, master's dissertation, was on sensory deprivation and perceptual defense. Okay, in the psychology department there. And those things show quite clearly, I spent months and months researching for that thing, and selective attention means that our personality, our motivation, and our fears guide what we see or don't see in the world. In perceptual defense, we are shielded from seeing things that are emotionally uncomfortable for us. Those are Jung's complexes. And there's a lot of scientific evidence. There's great science, Jerome Bruner, early studies at Harvard, all that kind of thing, that people see what they expect or what they want to see. So we all have within us a representation or a model of the world. Two lectures ago, we referred to that as Patanjali's citta vritti. It is the living stuff of which the psyche is made. Don't ever doubt that it's living. Your psyche is alive. And it has within it a formulation of the world. Now, what happens when you put somebody in solitary confinement or sensory deprivation?
Everything comes
to the surface.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a focus. So they focus all the way inward.
Their focus is not on the outside world, but it's this narrow field of experience, and your own stuff starts coming up to the surface, and you can eventually go mad with that, and that's what happens to people in solitary confinement. Strangely enough, there are Tibetan yogis that spend 3 years in solitude in caves. Mind-boggling. Yeah.
Alex was 4 years as a young man in solitary. Why don't you mention that?
Alex Polari?
Yeah.
Yeah, Alex Polari, my Brazilian shaman friend, he was politically active, and he and a bunch of guys attempted to kidnap the Swiss ambassador. In Brazil, the police are not quite as nice as they are around here. They broke his legs, and they threw him into solitary confinement for, I think, 5 years. He was in jail for 9 years.
He was about 20, I think.
He was about, no.
A little older?
No, it's only about nine.
Okay.
So, but that'll change you. He emerged a different man. So.
He was very young.
So, in order to experience the world at all, this is what the developmental psychologists show and tell us, we need to have an inner representation of it. When we go mad, that living inner representation, the citta vritti, goes wild and goes out of control. It has a storm inside. And that is visible in the brainwaves very often. And what that means is in psychosis, for example, you build a deformed version of the world. That's a delusion. I know these guys, they've been following me around for days. There's their car. It's a Buick. I see it over there. You know, they've been following me around for a long time. My telephones are being tapped, or God appeared to me and told me that I'm the next Messiah, or something like that. So there are both, when you have both hallucinations and delusions, you have quite a distortion of your world. Think about dreaming at night then. What happens when you dream at night is the chittavritti stretches its muscles, wakes up, and starts living. Your dreams come to life when you go to sleep. And they probably do penetrate our waking consciousness, as Jerome Bruner showed years ago, and because it's our psyche is involved in all of our perceptions. It's called apperception, the emotionally toned perceptions. I think of Heinz Werner and all these wonderful people I studied at Columbia. So the dreaming brain, revisiting the mythic imagination, realizing that myths and dreams contain the same thing. There was a great gold rush on the mythic imagination around 1900. Freud and Jung and Herbert Silberer and a little bit later Roberto Assagioli all were identifying depth psychology, the depths of the unconscious, and talking about the myths and dreams. And Freud's only problem was that he stopped short. He got very caught up in the Oedipus complex, and he was very happy with that one. Every young boy wants to kill his father and marry his mother, right? And then his women colleagues said, that's a one-sided patristic model you have there. What about women? Let's read Greek mythology. Ah, Electra. She wants to kill her mother and marry her father. Ah, very good, same kind of thing. And then he got on to Narcissus. Narcissus looks at his own image in a pool and falls in. And he kind of stopped there. Jung chided him. If you ever get a chance, read the Freud-Jung papers edited by William McGuire, old friend of ours. We haven't seen him for a long time, but he did a careful, careful job with that. And it's very telling. And Jung rebukes Freud, and he says, Sigmund, you stopped short with the Oedipus complex, the Electra complex, and Narcissus. There's a million other things. There's the hero's journey. There's the underworld. There's the witch. There's the wise old man. There's thousands and thousands of archetypes out there. Why aren't you exploring those? And Freud said, ah, nonsense. Yeah, you're going off the deep end, Jung, you know. And Jung, in fact, when he broke up his relationship with Freud, did go off the deep end a bit. When you look at his journals, when you read the biography, he kind of went a little nuts. It's not an easy thing to do, break up with your mentor, especially if you really, you know, are deeply affected by the person. Jung went down to the Zurich Sea and played in the sand on the beach for months. And that's when the origins of sand play, Dora Kalf, a Swiss colleague of his, developed it fully in a sandbox. And I have a sandbox right in my office. And let me tell you, that thing gets a lot of use. Little kids come into the office and they go, oh, wow, can I play with that? I said, I'd be unhappy if you didn't. And so we open up the sandbox and they start playing. And in the beginning, I just saw perfect examples of this last week. A disturbed, developmentally disabled little kid came in. The sandbox looked like a hurricane hit it. There was every conceivable kind of, no theme, whatever. And the next week, biofeedback treatment, a little better, a little more organized. I have examples of that in the first neurofeedback book, and there you see beginning of therapy and end of therapy, chaos and a beautiful, orderly little village with some figures in it and a kind of a realistic representation of reality. His brain is becoming more organized. As the brain becomes more organized, your world becomes more organized. Guess what? So the dream portal method, that's the handout that I gave you a very brief version of. And I hope you'll use this. We can go over it if people have questions about it. But what I want to teach students of dreaming, I've been teaching it for 20-some years, 26 years, I guess, started out with the psychologist named Robin Sherm, who was a specialist in dissociative identity disorder. And then when I needed, she moved up out of the area, and I needed another Robin to teach my dream course with, and Robin came along. Now we've shifted much more over to the creative arts and poetry. And in fact, I'm going to invite her to do her poem. Do you have the Kertu poem there?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have it in paper or just on your
I
computer?
Have it on the, I can just put this in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah, whenever.
So the Dream Portal Method. Respect your dreams. Have enough respect for them to have a little notebook. Here's mine of some 25 years duration. It has all kinds of sections in it for poetry and notes, and it has a calendar in it. I'd be lost without this thing. Keep it by your bed and open to a clean page, and you have a pen there, and think about it. What do you like when you come to a place, a little hotel or motel to go to sleep? You want clean sheets and a bed to climb into. Well, your dreams, look for clean sheets and a bed to climb into. That's your notebook. Okay. So let your dreams crawl into your dream notebook. Otherwise, you won't remember them. And why won't you remember them? Think back to our lecture on brain physiology. There are different frequencies going on. How many people have trouble trying to remember their dreams? Yeah.
I tape them.
You tape them. Good. Excellent. They're a different frequency. When you go into waking consciousness, you're using one set of brain waves to grope back and try and remember the brain waves when you were in a different physiological state, and they're different brain waves. So don't worry. My patients always come in and say, I only remember a fragment of this dream. I say, good, give it to me. Here we go. We start off with that fragment, and that fragment leads you wherever you're going to need to go. And that's what Whitmont taught me. He says that you'll never have complete dream recall. And dreams are a different form of consciousness, so you can never get the whole thing, and it doesn't make logical sense. It does make poetic sense, and we'll come back to that. Anybody know what dream incubation is? Emerges from the cult of Asclepius, but Native Americans did it all the time. You create a temenos, a sacred space, you sleep in it, and you ask for a healing dream. You don't know what the dream is going to be, but you ask for something, and it'll help you. Taking liberties with the dream, lucid dreaming. There's a whole cult out there based on the Jungian Sonoy dream method. It's kind of an oxymoron. But the Sonoy dream method uses active imagination or fantasy activity as a way of completing the incomplete parts of dreams. It can be very, very useful, very helpful. So if you have an incomplete dream, or if you want to get some more information, allow yourself to just kind of drift into a reverie. And some of you may have noticed that if you're falling asleep, which is theta, the vestibule to the unconscious, you can actually have hallucinations. You can hear telephones ringing, you can hear conversations with people, you can see things and hear things. How many people have experienced that? It's called the hypnagogic or hypnopompic state. Dreaming while awake, theta and active imagination. Taking liberties with the dream. I should have said a little bit more about that. I'm not so sure I always like it, but sometimes I do like it. What the Sonoy guys basically say is that if you meet a monster in your dream, you have a right to ask your dream power for a weapon to kill him. This came up at a humanistic psychology conference about 20 years ago. Somebody in the audience of several hundred people, somebody was leading a Sonoy dream thing, and raised his hands, and he said, I have this funny dream. He said, every time I'm in trouble and things seem to be going wrong, I dream of this man in a loincloth, and he's sitting there like he's meditating, and then he gets up and he begins to dance. When I wake up, I feel better. So the guy on the podium said, oh, that's your infant self. Now, what I suggest to you is you take that infant self and you make it smaller and smaller and put it in a box until it goes away.
He said he was in diapers. Remember that?
Yeah, he said, oh, that's your infant. He says that loincloth is a diaper. So I couldn't hold myself back. I'm in the back of a room of several hundred people. I say, excuse me, yeah, what do you want? I said, I think you're disrespecting this man's dream. He has an archetypal dream there. He's dreaming of Shiva. Shiva must be kept meditating because when he wakes up, he's dangerous. And he's responsible for a lot of the mischief in the world. But when he dances, it's incredibly beautiful. And the guy goes, yeah, that guy's got it. That guy's got it. And the guy on the podium goes, oh, so we have Jungians in the audience, do we? So there's really a conflict, a Sonoy Jungian approach to dreaming. Stephen LaBerge, some of you might have read his books. It's really an oxymoron. Yeah.